I'd like to welcome everyone to this teleseminar that we're having. My name is Larry Stoller, and I have with me Dr. Minas Kafatos, who's going to be speaking with us tonight or this afternoon or whenever you're listening to this on the topic of You Are the Universe, A Bold View of Reality, Consciousness, and Healing. The You Are the Universe part is happens to be the name of a book that Dr. Kafatos, Minas, has co-authored with Deepak Chopra that's recently been published, and I certainly encourage everyone to get a hold of it and read it. Just quickly, I just want to say that Minas Kafatos is a remarkably accomplished physicist and cosmologist and climate change researcher and has a great interest in consciousness. He makes him exactly the kind of person that we over at the Traditional Chinese Medicine World Foundation are very, very interested in, and we're more than honored to know that Minas will be joining us in the conference in the fall, the Building Bridges for TCM, Traditional Chinese Medicine Conference, in September 2017. I'll say more about that when we're finished tonight. And he'll be joining us in offering keynotes and hanging out with us and interacting with Grandmaster Lu, and all of us will be there, and hopefully you who are listening will come, and we'll have quite a remarkable time getting together. So I just want to welcome Minas to the call. We're doing this in the evening, so I'll say good evening to you. How are you tonight?
Thank you, Larry. I'm doing fine, and I'm glad to be part of this discussion or this discussion, and yes, so here we are.
Yes, I'm so glad. I really appreciate your making yourself available. So we're going to talk about the You Are the Universe concept, we have this title as A Bold View of Reality, Consciousness, and Healing, and I thought it would be really interesting because you have a unique vantage point to take on this question about what is reality. And as a physicist, you've been thinking a lot and researching and exploring the question of what's going on out there, or is there something going on out there? And I wonder if you could start with that and say something about the journey you've taken as a physicist into leading you to where you are today, and so you could write a book called You Are the Universe.
It's a bold statement, perhaps, from certain perspective, but I would say it's a perennial message of all traditions. The Dada tradition, the Tao tradition, the whole Eastern philosophical and spiritual thinking, that reality consists not as an external objective set of objects that particles, stars, etc., but it is integrated with the subjective part, and that's really the main point of the book, You Are the Universe. How did I reach this conclusion? Well, it's not really my conclusion. It is an ancient message, but it is has been confirmed or strengthened by modern quantum theory, which says that we live in a participatory universe, so to speak. In other words, we are co-creators of the universe, and we can't quite speak of a reality out there without taking into account our role in the participation of the unfolding of the universe.
It's the easiest thing to say, right? We can say these words, but their implication is so profound, right? I mean, to say that it's somehow the world, the whole universe, all the galaxies, all the stars, all the possibilities that are beyond what we can even imagine, somehow is linked to our own consciousness, right?
Correct. So everything is linked to us. We are linked to everything. Not perhaps as bold statement as it sounds, but we are used to looking out there. We see through the eyes and we hear through the ears, and we take it for granted that there are things out there, and they produce sensory messages that our senses capture, basically the sensory apparatus we have as part of our body captures, and then we say, well, there's a star out there because I can see the star. But really, how do we know that the star is there if it were not there? And when we say we're not there, or if it were not there, doesn't mean that the stars would disappear if, let's say, Minas disappear, or Larry disappear, or Master Lou disappear. We don't mean that at all. It just means that the experience is tied to the experienced object, and we cannot separate the two.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in your book, you describe this the experience of how we encounter the world. You have just some beautiful examples of, for example, how we see anything. And I think you talk about the sun, and the sun emits photons, and somehow these photons come to us. And can you say a little bit more about that, how that process works? Because it's quite remarkable how you describe it in the book.
Which aspect specifically?
So we have photons. They're invisible.
Yeah.
And, you know, they strike us through our eyes somehow, and mm-hmm. you know, our inner experience is filled with light. And
yes.
you know, there's nothing in the process itself that has actual light in it the way we experience it until it is in our experience, right?
Correct. Everything is in our experience. So until something is recorded and produces let's say signal, which is if you take that this in a picture, or if you know a CCD camera or whatever, it's recorded, then you have it, that picture forever. You have the sun appearing there on the image, and then you say, oh, the sun is out there because we captured the photons. But again, it all requires that someone looks at the picture, someone makes a decision to take a picture, and then someone interprets the picture. And we take those things for granted, but they're not really for granted. You know, they are tied all together. The experiencer or the observer, the object of experience, in this case the sun, and the process of experience or observation, they're all tied together.
That's a statement that holds true in from a perspective of quantum physics, which you know,
mm-hmm.
right? That's your area, and also is mirrored by many ancient wisdom statements, right? From wisdom traditions.
All right.
This is a common understanding we seem to be playing with right now. And did it surprise you, like in your personal journey, to come to this place, or did you have a sense this was the way it was going to be, you know, 30 years ago, earlier in your career when you were starting to explore, maybe longer than that, I don't know, explore, you know, quantum, the world of quantum mechanics and quantum physics?
Well, you know, I did start my career as an astrophysicist, and that, of course, is as far as it gets. You know, you look at the galaxies and the stars very far away, and you look, even with our naked eye, we look at the starry sky at night, and we look at the Milky Way, and it all looks, it's out there, very far away. But somehow this out there is tied to us who are doing the observation. So it is all through us as the observer that the circle closes.
Was there some point in your professional life where you started to see that was the case, that it was not going to be successful to think of it only as a universe out there, that, you know, it was all leading to recognizing that somehow we were participating in the experience of the universe?
Well, certainly that was, I was very much influenced by the Copenhagen interpretation and by the so-called orthodox quantum mechanics, primarily put together by people like Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg and John von Neumann and John Maxwell Wheeler, et cetera, et cetera. And to a certain extent, influenced by the opposition to it, which was Albert Einstein, primarily Albert Einstein, but other people as well, including Schrödinger, actually. So these were people who did a lot to formulate quantum mechanics, but they couldn't quite accept the idea that, as Einstein put it, is the moon not there when nobody's looking at it? And so, and of course, if you think about it, the question is meaningless because how do you know if the moon is there or not there when nobody's looking at it? Well, we certainly know that it's there when we look at it, but when nobody is looking at it, then what does that statement mean? So that sort of brings again full circle the whole issue of participation or participatory universe.
Whenever I hear about this, I think that we look at Einstein as such a hero. Of course, he, you know, genius, one of the remarkable scientific mind, and to see that in a way he landed on the, you know, on really one side of this argument, as opposed to, for example, the place you are and many people are. He was not able to really accept this deep idea, right, that there. What you would call now like the participatory universe, it would not have been something he was comfortable with.
Correct. So, again, Einstein did so much for quantum mechanics. In fact, he got the Nobel Prize for the explanation of the photoelectric effect. We should not forget that. But at the same time, he couldn't, and he fought. After a certain point in his life, he fought far against it because he felt that it is an objective reality. And of course, the so-called EPR experiment, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, which was a thought experiment back in 1935, 1936, eventually became Bell's theorem. And it was demonstrated in a laboratory that indeed non-locality is very much part of our reality. Contrary to what Einstein expected, and in fact, contrary to what John Bell himself expected. So this is very interesting how things turned out.
That's right. It's an example of how thoroughly tested quantum mechanics is. It wasn't.
Right.
It's a wildly radical theory at the time, maybe still today, and you know, so many of its principles have been tested, proven, shown, demonstrated. It's quite remarkable, right?
Right, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, from an outside perspective, I think people don't always realize that these are, you know, really, really challenging ideas that just to our usual frame of reference. But, you know, science has taken them, you know, tested them and shown that they hold up. So then we're left with what's the implication. And I think it's, you know, fascinating that there are such a broad range of practicing physicists and scientists who are you know very much holding to the idea that somehow we're going to figure out how the physical stuff exists out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So there's a kind of latent physicalism that's still at work that, you know, we see it in our society all the time because we could say, well, we're a very materialistic society. But underneath it, there's this other notion of quantum physics that you're part of that says, yes, there's stuff, but our experience of stuff is so vital to actually understanding what's going on. What do you think is happening that makes it so difficult for people to, you know, soften their physicalist stance?
Well, because it is, in some sense, it looks like it is counterintuitive or opposite to experience. I mean, we experience the world through the senses. And we take them for granted, but of course we know that the whole sensory, not the complete sensory apparatus, but a large part of it shuts down when we are in deep sleep, and even when we are dreaming, even though we see things in our dreams, there it's not really that these images are formed because our eyes are open. So as part of our experience, which is not really the everyday experience, unless we're daydreaming, so-called daydreaming, is that we have other states which go counter to this notion that the only reality out there is an external reality. But it is so ingrained into our thinking that and our experience that we don't really question it.
Another side of this is, it seems to me that the scientific, the hardcore scientific physicalist perspective takes it as a given that we're dealing with random events, that somehow mm-hmm. there's a chaotic randomness in the universe, and that this gives rise to us in the end, right? Here we are. Right. And so that side of scientific exploration wants to say, look, we're going to figure this out somehow, how this happens. And, you know, people who are taking the position you are, it seems, are saying that that's never going to happen. You can't get from that kind of randomness to this kind of order. And I know you write quite a bit about this in the book. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about, how we arrive at an understanding that there are such limits to the randomness idea.
So the randomness idea actually is very interesting because it allows things like free will to take place, and all of that, and so that is very significant, very important. There is no randomness to speak of, at least not in the quantum sense in classical theory, and there is no free will in classical theory.
Could you say that again? There's no free will. What?
There's no free will in classical theory.
Uh-huh.
Right. Mm-hmm. No. And so that dilemma, it doesn't really exist. I mean, it's a good dilemma, but it doesn't really exist. But certainly it's at the center, the centerpiece of quantum mechanics. So that's the dilemma, you know. It looks like the universe is participatory, that it is that the objects are entangled, and that we're dealing with potentialities of happenings and not absolute certainties that something will happen. So.
It's a vital distinction in the end, right? I mean, if you're going to have a conscious participatory universe, in a way, it's the creative principle is in action to produce the world we see somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you wrote about, you know, like if you think about everything being random, then you just sort of like put a bunch of atoms and molecules in an enormous jug and shake them up and assume you're going to get worlds and suns and planets and, you know, living things and animals and plants and human beings eventually, somehow.
Right.
Yeah. There's a sense from the people who think that randomness is a necessary feature of a physical universe. They think you could get there from here, get here from there into,
right.
you know, some kind of organized, you know, ordered universe.
Correct. And this is just not the way things are, at least the way we see them how they are today.
Uh-huh. I think that I think you said something else in the book that I thought was pretty interesting, that one of the founders of quantum physics said something about, like, we can't really imagine that, you know, atoms could have a consciousness. You know, we couldn't really think of them as being agents, right? Like, I think it's Eddington you quoted in your book, who says, like, you know, atoms, and this is what you wrote, atoms in the lab are weird stuff, behaving like active agents rather than inert substances. Mind is to some extent inherent in every atom. Maybe that was Eddington. But, you know, right? I mean, that's such a bold statement again.
Right. Well, again, it doesn't really mean that they have a mind like human beings. And, how do we know that? I mean, you know, this whole debate is about zombies, you know, something that looks and feels like a human being and has all the reactions that a conscious being would have. It doesn't necessarily mean that this robot or whatever is a human being or a conscious being, but it could be very well just be a zombie who actually part, but it's not conscious. So, those issues have not gone away. There's still being argued, you know, and this is now almost 100 years or so since Orenbeck's quantum theory was put together in the late 20s and early 30s. By a bunch of young physicists, primarily young physicists, which is, of course, now today we call it the Orenbeck's quantum view of the universe. So the debates remain, even though the points that are being debated were there before. You know what I mean?
I do. They're enduring questions that make us. I mean, when you're curious, you encounter these kinds of questions, and they grab you. They make you really want to understand more and think more deeply about what's happening. And I know I see that in your writing and in how you describe what you discovered in your journey. And,
right.
And another thing I was curious about is you reference in your book and probably in other books you've written many books, Eastern thinkers that have influenced you. And did you at some point begin to have an interest in Eastern thought or these kinds of indigenous wisdom, ancient wisdom? Did that become part of your? Was that like a scholarly interest or a personal interest? How did you start to be interested?
It was both scholarly and personal. But yeah, it was early on, and I experienced meditation, et cetera, and then study some of the ancient teachings for several years, and
So you're, to me, it's like this journey for you personally is an example of something that's looks like a unique feature of a person living in our time, which is to have such a deep understanding of science, and also quite a deep personal understanding, affinity, experience with Eastern practice. This merging between East and West seems to be a very, very, very fertile ground right now. I mean, that's something I think we're very interested in at the Foundation and the Traditional Chinese Medicine World Foundation, and in the conferences that we do, we're very much interested in looking at how the language of science and quantum physics can become something that is it's not such a big leap anymore to go from that understanding, the language and also the understanding, into these deeper realms, so-called deeper realms that are reflected in Eastern, like, mystical thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct. Of course, there have been some books around, and like the Tao physics, that now it's in the 70s, right? It was published in the late 70s. So,
yeah, they're talking about the Tao of physics, that book, sure. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that in the 70s, in the late 70s, there was, a sort of a second or a third quantum revolution where younger physicists started saying, well, maybe this is connected to ancient teachings. And certainly at that time I was a graduate student, so at least in the early part of the sense of the graduate student, so eventually I was influenced by it. So,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and that just, so you were part of that. You got exposed to those ideas, what you're calling the newer generation, right? It was
beyond physics. Yeah, newer generation, and I would say I was not in the middle of it, but certainly very quickly I learned about all the efforts and became fascinated with them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think many of us who were interested, I'm not a physicist, but I'm interested in these questions, you know, we started reading the Tao of Physics and the Dancing Wu Li Masters and
right.
You know, these books that started, it was also around the same time, and, you know, because it was so exciting to mm-hmm. think about these questions from both the science side and from the sort of Eastern mystical side. And then, you know, from my experience as somebody who's exploring these questions also as a practitioner in a healing practice and having now been exposed
mm-hmm,
to
mm-hmm.
The way that Grandmaster Lu thinks and sees the world very much, I think, you know, very similarly to you in some key ways, you know, but having come mm-hmm. to it through a deep understanding of the possibilities that are available in the worldview that has become, you know, Chinese medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And these now become practical. I mean, they've been used for thousands of years, and
mm-hmm.
the foundation of them looks very much like, you know, in a sense, quantum, you know, information paradigms put into practice.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, that is the case.
Which is, yeah. It's remarkable. And I know, so you had a chance to meet Grandmaster Lu and talk with him. And so did you start to have a dialogue about this with him?
We started having a dialogue. Of course, it was not a very long time that we met. It was in New York City.
Yeah.
And I was in transit. We was just, in fact, a couple of days after our first book signing with Deepak Chopra.
Oh,
it was a busy time. Yeah, it was a busy time, but we chatted and we agreed to have deeper discussions during the September meeting in Virginia.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, that's great. So, you know, I think that in Chinese medicine, I don't know how much study you've done of Chinese medicine. I know that, again, you reference other you know, other people. I see more Indian references in your work, but maybe you have studied Chinese medicine. But, you know, there's notions like we wrestle with the understanding of yin and yang, and, you know,
right.
These opposites, and and then quantum physics. There's the notion of complementarity. I mean,
mm-hmm.
these ideas dance together very nicely, right?
That's correct. That's right. Those ideas mesh very well with Taoism and Chinese medicine, and of course also Buddhism. You know, whether of the Bon variety from Tibet or the Zen variety of Buddhist. So they're not really unique to one particular system of thought, but certainly a lot of it is has to do at least in the way I was trained from the Vedantic and Kashmir Shaivite point of view, which is the non-dual aspects of from Hindu, or I should say Indian, ancient Indian thinking.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the idea that this notion of non-duality is beyond, really, beyond the world that we experience in any kind of phenomenal way, mm-hmm. is, you know, maybe the true reality. And that's, so, you know, we, you know, on a practical level, again, if we live our everyday life and we mm-hmm. encounter difficulties, for many people, you know, we might say, you know, even like in a health, from a health framework, if you say like, I'm having a, you know, problems with my shoulder today, let's say, and then my range of motion is very limited, and you can just say, you know, well, that's my shoulder problem. And, you know, you get really focused, especially if you're in kind of a Western medicine perspective, you really start understanding all the mechanics and the issues around the shoulder. It's very physical.
Right.
And, you know, when we apply these ideas, we start realizing, like, can't just be a shoulder here. I mean, even in a deeper sense, if we apply what you're saying, my awareness of my shoulder, I mean, the shoulder isn't out there either.
No.
Even though it seems like my body is out there, it's not out there like, you know, the Milky Way. It's much closer, mm-hmm. but it still seems like it's out there. Because even my shoulder is out there. And
that's right.
That already changes how, you know, influences how we think about our own health. If we could shift and mm-hmm. say, like, my experience of my shoulder is somehow, the pain in my shoulder is somehow, I'm participating in that. We can mm-hmm. start to open up new avenues for healing.
Correct. Yeah. I agree with what you're saying. Yeah.
Is that, do you find yourself thinking about those kinds of applications at all? Or, I mean, because you're not, obviously, don't work in a, you know, within a healing context, but do you think about how these ideas could make a difference?
Actually, these days, even though I'm not directly involved with healing myself, except we're all tied to our own healing, right? I now get invited to these conferences, besides yours, all the conferences that have to do really with Eastern medicine and acupuncture and quantum mechanics and things like that. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we see, you know, we think about the way to support or promote deeper healing. It involves a shift in how we see things. And I think it's a shift very much in keeping with the framework that you're offering. And mm-hmm. So if everything underneath has a kind of consciousness and we know there's energy there,
mm-hmm.
then that, you know, consciousness of what? You know? And energy is coming from where? I mean, I think that, you know, we don't always realize in a deeper sense of what is this energy that we're talking about? Because, you know, I think this is one place where, like, the Chinese framework, it offers something slightly different from, say, the Western scientific view, because everybody's talking about energy, right? I mean,
right.
We have 100 years of recognizing that everything's energy, more than 100 years, right? E equals mc squared, everything's energy.
Mm-hmm.
But what? What's the energy? And then, you know, Chinese framework, we start talking about qi. And, you know, that's a way of speaking about life, the life force, the creative, you know, intelligence that's guiding our lives.
Correct.
But, you know, again, that's a place where there's an easier opportunity to have a conversation between, say, physics and, you know, a healing discipline like Chinese medicine, because we start to use the same word anyway of energy.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. That's absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm. So when you think of energy, what do you think of? Like, what is the energy that, or in a physics sense, what's the energy we're talking about?
Well, energy, of course, in physics has a very specific set of definitions. It has to do with the ability to do work or to move objects around, and there are different kinds of energies, low grade and high grade. Low grade, lowest grade energy is thermal heat, and high grade energies are gravitational, you know, lifting, having an object at a certain height, and then letting drop, you know, and of course there's nuclear energy. So there are different kinds of grades of energy. They're all related to each other, and when we say grades, it has to do with the second law of thermodynamics, and whether, you know, as you reverse a particular process, how, what kind of efficiency you can get out of it.
Uh-huh.
And so from that point of view, you know, we pretty much know what physics says, classical thermodynamics and classical physics says. But here we're talking about something more. We're really talking about conscious energy.
Yes.
And, yeah.
And how do you integrate that?
Well, I would say that there's no energy that's not conscious.
There's no energy that's not conscious? Is that what you said?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, from our framework, I think totally agree with that. And so that's a core claim that you'd be making, right? Consciousness is fundamental. So energy with consciousness.
Correct.
And, you know, so, I just think when you say that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, you know, life, the life force, consciousness, and the world out there are all related to each other.
The life force, consciousness, and the world, in other words, what we see, what seems to be happening out there, the stuff of the world, they're all related.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really your main claim from you are the universe and somehow through consciousness and the energy that carries consciousness.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, again, I just think it's so exciting. It's thrilling really to me that we could be exploring this and that you've come to this from, you know, serious scientific perspective.
Right.
And that these ideas are also, you know, so deeply rooted in frameworks like Chinese medicine, where I think exactly that statement could be made that energy has consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has consciousness. So if we go back to your shoulder problem, I'm using an example of shoulder problem.
Right, right.
That would mean consciousness. Go ahead. What's that?
In my case, it's my back problem. But
your back problem. Yeah, whatever, right? Whatever the problem
is. Right,
Yeah, that must mean there's some kind of consciousness associated with that expression.
Correct.
And, you know, the energy that's required in order to create the condition and the expression that we see in our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So then medicine looks like a medicine about consciousness, right?
Yeah, medicine and well-being actually are, I think, as you said before, really integral part of who we are.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, we have on the one hand the sort of physicalists in science, and then there's the physicalists in medicine. And, you know, like to make a statement that we could see as I do, that consciousness and energy are, you know, really at the root of understanding our illness and our discomfort and chaos, internal chaos is such a bold claim compared to the, you know, prevailing understanding that really it's physical.
Right.
We're right back in the same dilemma.
Right.
Right? Yeah. It's just another area to look at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that I know since, for me personally, since I've studied with Grandmaster Lu now some years, that I really see it more clearly, that it's not the physical first. The physical is there. We notice it. Certainly I notice it. You notice your back.
Mm-hmm.
Notice my shoulder. Or anyone can notice whatever their problem is. We notice it, and we don't want to confuse what we notice from what's actually happening.
Yeah.
Which is energy and consciousness somehow. That's what you're saying. That's what I'm saying.
That's what you were saying. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating that we could use the same language.
Yeah, it's the same language because it's the same experience, really.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah, and then there's one other thing that I think is also very common between the work you're doing and the way you're expressing it and what we're also interested in, and that has to do with the process or the explorations of self-awareness. Because you also write about this, that, you know, self-awareness through practices like meditation or whatever is really important in terms of understanding the primary consciousness that's with us. Did I have that right?
I think so, yeah. I think you do.
I'm just rephrasing what I read in your book. I wonder if I phrased it correctly.
I think that's, yeah, pretty much the same. Yeah, pretty much the idea. Yeah.
So how does that work? I mean, what's the way in which these practices and the effort to, you know, gain more self-awareness serves us?
Could you be more specific?
So I'll try. Right. I know I see here you've written that this is, I think, near the end of your book, you list it's like 30-35, you know.
Oh, points. Yeah, you mean the, yeah, yeah.
You mean, and you say spiritual practices fine-tune self-awareness.
Right.
And when the tuning is fine enough, and then you speak a lot in the, you know, second half of your book about qualia, which I don't know if we need to talk about right now, but when the fine-tuning is enough, it's through this self-awareness practice.
Correct.
Then we don't have to, we're no longer masking reality. We can see reality directly.
Right.
Right? So, yeah, I wonder if you could speak about that a bit more.
Well, the fine-tuning really has to do with what do a lot of us call meditation, but meditation doesn't necessarily need to be, does not need to be with closed eyes, but it is focused, understanding focused, bringing to one's awareness of what one wants to study or to experience. So in that sense, that's what's taking place. You know, that we by focusing, our awareness becomes more finely tuned. And more finely tuned it becomes, then we have the capacity to go even deeper and deeper. And so it's an iterative process that doesn't really stop with a meditation session, but it keeps getting more and more. And what is, I would say, is most important in the fantastical point of view is to not give up, number one. And second, to not have expectations that something will go this way or that way. This is very important. Just doing the effort to sit down and doing a contemplation is, I wouldn't say it's good enough, but certainly it's the biggest portion of it. And consistency makes something finer, and I wouldn't call it perfect, but certainly moving more and more into perfection.
I think that sounds like very wise advice, especially the part about, you know, well, two, you say two things, you have to persist, right? And
right.
You can't be caught up in, you know, too much in a set of expectations about what you're actually going to find.
Right.
You have to be very open.
Right. You have to be very open. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that in the process of our everyday life, and again, if we're thinking about, you know, something like, you know, illness, discomfort, since we're inclined, most people are inclined to see the problem as out there. The problem out there let's say, your back, my shoulder, whatever, right? It's very compelling, and we want to do something about it out there. So we look for a remedy out there. If we take the other path and look for a remedy that's internal, that's, you know, we're going to look for an answer that's within, you know, we encounter a lot of noise and confusion and chaos and disruption as soon as we start to do something that's internal. So you really have to have some courage, right, to keep that going, because it's you know, the encounter with yourself is, ennobling, but it can also along the way be, you know, terrifying. What we create, the world we create inside. In some ways, easier to keep it outside, like just deal with all that stuff out there.
Right. Correct.
I think when you say correct, I always feel like I'm, you know, because you're a teacher, you know, like I feel like I'm, you know, getting an answer right, and it feels somewhat satisfying to me. But, you know, we're trying to, you know, shed light on these really deep aspects of our experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. That is indeed the case, and also what is the case is that this is a journey without, I would say, without an end. I mean, you know, it's an unfolding process, and there are lampposts here and there, and but at the end of the day, it really ought to be a fun journey, and not a journey that becomes burdensome. We have too many burdens as it is in our everyday life.
That's right.
And so this is actually where the idea of healing comes in, and to be whole is to be part of the universe and to move forward, but without really getting too uptight about it, you know.
Right, not to be too uptight, but to just trust the process.
Exactly, trust the process, and there are going to be ups and downs, and
that's great. Well, I think this might be a great place to stop. Do you have anything else you feel compelled to, you know, that's come to you as insight or something from what we've been talking about that you want to share?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. I'm looking forward to interact more in the fall in Virginia and with Grandmaster Lou, and to interact with a live audience, you know, being there and sharing experiences and being together physically. I mean, it's great to do this teleconference, but it would be also good to be together in under one roof and have fun. So
Yes. Yeah, I think so. And I'm looking forward as well, and so are you know, all of us connected to the conference. And I do want to just take a minute. First, I want to thank you for making yourself available and sharing with us your thoughts and wisdom about this whole process of thinking about that, you know, you are the universe. We are all participating in this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate that. And I just want to remind people who are listening that the conference we're talking about is the Building Bridges for Traditional Chinese Medicine Conference. And this year it's September 14th through 17th in Reston, Virginia. And there's information about the conference on the tcmworld.org website, www.tcmworld.org. Just look up the conference tab there and you'll be seeing information there. And we welcome everyone to come to this meeting. It's quite extraordinary, really. Minas will be there, and we have other quite remarkable speakers. And what he's talking about is this kind of interaction that happens at the conference is something that people who come to the conference always remark about their experience. It's a very deep and actually energy-filled experience. Where we do interact and we do share this experience together and learn together, and also because it's a healing space, there's always the possibility for some transformative or transformational personal experience. So again, Minas, I want to thank you for your time and your thoughts here, and I look forward to seeing you a number of months away in the fall. I don't want to think about the fall. I want to think about the summer right now.
The summer, right? Well, it's spring right now, but yeah, okay.
We're getting there.
Getting there.
Right. We're getting there. And yeah, so it's great. So thanks thanks once again.
Thank you for having me, and we will see you later.
You bet. Take care.
Thank you. Thanks so much.